What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik on America Trends. Hey, John, have you heard that ad where the guy says, he's on meds too. We're all on meds. Yeah. You've heard that one?
I have.
Yeah, he's got high blood pressure. Right. Oh, my goodness. Is everybody in America on
well,
just
if you watch
whole...
TV, I think everybody is on some kind of drug.
Yeah, what goes on the 6:30 nightly news? Not that I watch it often, but my goodness. I mean, they don't have time after they give all the side
and
effects.
And who makes up these names?
Oh, I don't know. Genaquil. Wanovex. You know, oh my goodness, I know, absolutely. Well, prescription drug pricing. You ever wonder, John, how did they figure out that this pill should cost me $400 and this pill, well, you know, so cheap, we'll almost give you a whole pile of them for $4. And who is going to pay for this and why the insurance companies look upon this as being part of a formulary or not?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Plus, then you got older people. I remember they were taking bus trips to Canada to pick up drugs because they were cheaper up there because the way the system is up there. So,
well, that's another really good point because we all hear these stories that, oh, all the drugs are cheaper in other countries. So we want to delve into that too. Believe me, I wanted to understand, as you know, in the questioning that we did of James Capretta, I wanted to know how did this system develop? Because it seems like a Rubik's Cube.
It is.
And nobody understands it. And here we are baffled by it. We're fighting insurance companies. We're begging our doctor to give us samples, whatever it may be.
And how about that guy that bought the EpiPen, right? And
oh,
he did a 600% markup on it? Come on.
How is that even possible? How is that allowed? Well, with all that said, this really is a vexing problem in America, one of the most vexing. So the question is, how does it all come about? What are the considerations that we have to look at? And I found, John, just as I always do whenever we really dig deeply, it's much more complicated than we like to make it sound, or the politicians when they're telling us, right, we're going to lower drug prices. Well, let's start with the cost of innovation in drugs. Let's talk about government support of research. Let's talk about, you know, the way that marketing plays a role, the way the insurance companies come into this, and the way the limited number of distributors that we have, right, available to us in terms of wholesale also control the dynamic. So in America, it's not a simple process. And then, John, we haven't even talked about the role that government plays. Why are government officials not interceding more to negotiate prices?
Let's face it, the pharmaceutical companies have a lot of dough.
Well, you notice that even in the Affordable Care Act, there was a lot of carve-outs for the prescription, right, drug companies. But don't forget, John, I thought that we had dealt with a lot of this as it relates particularly to older folks with the Part D of Medicare.
Right.
And so the question is, well, what does that do? And we still have that donut hole in the middle of Medicare where people say, wait a minute, this drug was cheaper before I entered this donut hole. When do I come out of this?
Well, you know, donuts are bad for you.
I know. Why would you be eating donuts and taking prescription drugs? Well, we're going to be talking about all of this. There's an incredible report, and we do give you the information as to how you can get it at the end of the podcast. But it's done by the American Enterprise Institute. It's part of their Economic Perspective series, Prescription Drug Pricing, an overview of the legal, regulatory, and market environment. James Capretta is one of the authors of this report. And John, it's really illuminating. And it's very readable. Honest to goodness, it really is. So we don't always say read every book or read every report, but this one might be one that you'll want to get a hold of because we are all affected by this.
Absolutely.
Either for an older parent or for ourselves or whatever it
may be. Or just for watching TV.
Yeah, just to help you guide your way through those television ads. Well, we're going to get into all of it today on America Trends.
Jim Capretta is with us from the American Enterprise Institute, and he, along with Joseph Antos, have done a report on prescription drug pricing, an overview of the legal, regulatory, and market environment. And Jim, I've got to say that so many people are concerned about the price of prescription drugs here in America, and yet nobody seems to be able to get a handle on this.
Well, that's quite true. It's a complicated subject, and how we do things in the United States probably makes it even more complicated than it needs to be. And of course, these are really important questions because many of these products, these therapies, are quite important to people's health. And so the fact that there is a price attached to them at all that people have to pay can cause some consternation, and the fact that they can be quite expensive, you know, adds to the frustration. So it's a very sensitive topic, and for understandable reasons.
Well, many people, I think, because we've been so divorced from the bill-paying process as it relates to medical, always bringing in a third-party payer, that a lot of people think that things should be free. Obviously, reading your report, I've got to say, you lay out chapter and verse why things are so expensive. Would you like to try to summarize that?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot, and we can, I'm sure, add as we go here. The primary reason why, of course, drugs can be expensive is it's a combination of really two things. The first being that our government confers intellectual property rights on inventors. Of course, probably many of your listeners know and understand that our Constitution required that as a core responsibility of our federal government to provide protection to inventors for their intellectual property for some limited duration. That was written right into the Constitution. And I think for good reasons. The reason obviously being that it then provides a powerful incentive for inventors to come up with new ways of doing things that will be beneficial and thus valuable in the marketplace. This protection, of course, is limited. So patents now run for 20 years. And that means that once the patent expires, the intellectual property that went into it is then part of the public domain and can be used by anybody. So what does this do? This means that in many dimensions of our economy, things can be improved. Someone invents something, a new whiz-bang way of doing something, and they are able to sell that product in the market with considerable pricing power because they have the property rights to it. Mm-hmm. They can set the price pretty high if it's a very valuable thing, and they have some additional ability to leverage high prices for what they've done. Now, in most realms, that's fine. In the realm of health, of course, it adds another level of sensitivity because the demand for that product could be quite high, really related to the fact that people's health might be associated with consumption of it. So we confer the same kind of property right on drug companies if they come up with a new product that is different from anything that else has been invented before. And if that product is very valuable as a therapy, you've got the combination of pricing power for the inventor, and a lot of demand from patients who say, I really need that. So when you have those two things in combination, in an economic sense, it's quite predictable that the price will be high. Now, having said all that, there are other reasons why prices are high also, beyond the intellectual property and consumer demand.
Before we get into some of those, would you say that this ongoing tension, as you call it, between promoting innovation and maintaining access to affordable, safe, and effective medical treatments, is that the key reason? Or as we get into some of the rebating and the wholesalers and so forth, are they contributing mightily to the cost factor here?
I would say that's quite a good question. It's hard to quantify these things, but I would tend to lean to the point that no research has really been done trying to separate all the different factors. But I would say that my own judgment would be that the intellectual property aspect of this is really the number one reason why prices can be high. That you've conferred an ability on someone who's come up with a new product to set the price without any direct competition. And that means that they're going to be able to set the price high because they can't be undercut by some other supplier. So that's a very important factor.
And by the way, before we move past that, and I'm glad that you highlighted that and put that in red, the question a lot of people have, number one, if the government's involved at the early stage of the development, as the National Institutes of Health often might be, why shouldn't the public get greater benefit if public monies went into this at the outset?
That's a very good question and a valid one. I think that a couple of things to say about that. It's quite true that the basic research that comes out of NIH is foundational for a lot of things that go on afterwards. But making a direct connection a lot of times between that foundational research and a therapy on the market, it can be a little bit of a, you know, long process from one to the other. And so it's a little bit hard to disentangle who did what and whose investment led to the therapy. One thing I'd note here is that there's very few people who would contend that we don't need a vibrant and dynamic commercial marketplace of biopharmaceutical companies trying to develop these products because, well, the government can do it all on its own. No one really believes that, because commercializing science, taking something that is kind of at the basic level and moving it into a product that can be produced, mass-produced, and sold through the marketplace, the research and effort that goes into that is quite valuable, and so companies are going to have to be rewarded for doing that. I would be in favor, and people have suggested it in the past, of trying to disentangle this a bit and see if we could figure out how much of the intellectual property really came from the inventor and how much of it might have come from already publicly funded research. If someone were able to disentangle that and make that known, I certainly would be in favor of adjusting the property rights accordingly.
What about the notion that a lot of people have that the innovation takes place in the United States, but the benefit goes to others in different countries and not to us?
Very legitimate point. It's quite true that the United States has the most vibrant and dynamic biopharmaceutical industry in the world. The companies here invent the most new products, bring the new products onto commercial development and sales. So, you know, we lead the world in that realm. We got a lot of scientists, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of venture capital going into the effort. And then other countries have nationalized health systems where the government says, great, we got a new product, but we're going to set the price at some much lower level than what is being charged commercially in the United States. That is quite true. That's going on. I think one thing to keep in mind here is that when you look at the data, the wealthier the country, the more those countries are spending on their drugs. Nobody spends as much per product as the United States, but some pretty rich countries are getting closer than you might think, Germany being one. They do spend quite a bit on drugs themselves, in part because the drug companies extract high prices from their nationalized system. The only way to combat that issue would be to start to try to intervene here in the United States and say, well, we don't want our pricing to get so out of whack with what's going on internationally that we're overly subsidizing consumption elsewhere. And the only way to do that would be to have the government get involved in trying to create what would be called an international reference price, which is done in some countries already, and peg what we're paying here more closely to what's being paid elsewhere. That'd be an awfully big step, and I have to consider, you know, some of the pros and cons of it before I myself would jump on it. You know, it certainly would then put pressure back on other countries to maybe have their prices more.
But Jim, there are a lot of people seeing the government as wrapped up as they are in healthcare. I mean, let's be honest about it. About 50% of all healthcare dollars are spent by the government. Why don't they negotiate more aggressively as it relates to drug prices?
I think we tried to write in our paper, and I think it's pretty clear that there's a direct connection between an incentive to get intellectual property and be able to price their products accordingly, having the government being involved in setting prices. I don't think it's an accident that other countries have less vibrant biopharma industries than we do, right? So, the tension we're trying to bring to bear here and make clear here is that the more the government gets involved and says, we're not paying for all this stuff, the less of it you're going to get. In other words, it would affect new products, new innovation, new developments down the road, and we want both. All right.
So that's America. We want everything. But, you know, we did try with the Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act of 1984 to get some of these generics into the marketplace sooner. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act addressed some of the concerns about the price of prescription drugs. Have either of these two particular acts done much for the American public?
The 1984 Act has done very, very much. It really has been the starting point for a vibrant, large, and effective generic drug industry. So once they passed that law, popularly known as Hatch-Waxman, for its sponsors, Senator Orrin Hatch and Congressman Henry Waxman.
Yeah, and it's easier to say.
It's easier to say. I'm trying to help you out here. So, you know, that really became the starting point for a very large and vibrant industry. So there's quite a bit of financial pressure and movement toward generic consumption once drugs do come off patent and off of market exclusivity. And that's a very good thing. So we've got, for small molecule drugs where it's fairly easy to copy a, you know, a product through a patent unveiling, you know, through the you know, being able to bring that to market, pretty much every drug that, you know, comes off patent is going to have a generic available that's going to cost, you know, a fraction of what the branded product costs.
And what are we looking at in terms of protection? Is it 20 years? What is the length of time?
The patents run 20 years, but by the time you get out of FDA's regulatory process and have your drug on market, I think the average length of market exclusivity can be a little over a decade.
Okay. And as we look at the generics, how long is the first generic into the market protected, or are they not? Can you have multiples of that right at the get-go when, in fact, generics are allowed into the marketplace?
To get that first generic in, they provide some market protection for that product as well. I believe it's about a half a year. It's not very long.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, eventually you can have unlimited numbers of generic products available. And, you know, you have some products that have come off patent where things are, you know, you got pills that are, you know, literally a dollar, 50 cents a pill now because of the generic industry. So you've really brought down the price of some products that are quite valuable for patients but have come off patent many years ago.
Well, we've got Jim Capretto with us, Prescription Drug Pricing, an overview of the legal, regulatory, and market environment. We'll tell you how to get this report, and it really is illuminating, I've got to say. Parts of it a little difficult to get through, but in general, to understand why it is that we're paying what we are for prescription drugs, this is really important. You get into the pharmaceutical supply chain, and you say it's complex with various intermediaries, each of whom have a financial interest and considerable influence over the distribution and pricing of prescription drugs. And that's a mouthful, but it's true.
It is true. And I think that there's a couple things to keep in mind here. You know, these products are not like selling, widgets in a hardware store or something. I mean, there's a whole series of regulatory requirements on making sure that the chain of custody of these products is airtight so that what ends up in a patient's body, you know, is really what has been, you know, on the label and says it is, right?
So, and make certain that people understand that chain of custody and how that might add to the cost in America, but ensure the safety.
Well, you know, obviously, drugs can only be distributed through pharmacies, which are licensed by the states. You have requirements in terms of licensing of wholesalers who buy the drugs from manufacturers and then distribute them to the nation's pharmacies around the country, retail and mail order. And each of them has requirements about making sure that the products are stored safely and securely and in an environment that ensures their integrity. So, and for very, very, drugs that can, if misused, are dangerous, there are special requirements that the FDA imposes on the chain of custody in terms of how they're handled, A, to make sure that they don't go on the black market, and B, to make sure that patients aren't harmed. So there's a lot of things that go into all of this. it's not like a normal product because people's health is involved. And so that adds a lot of layers of regulatory control that make the cost go up to some degree.
And somebody might listen to this and say, well, why do we need the wholesalers in the middle of this process? Why can't the manufacturers sell directly? And there are only three major wholesalers. We've got McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal Health. Someone might say, well, why is there not more competition in this realm?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is that, you know, there are probably two dozen or so major pharmaceutical companies. And if you're a pharmacy, it's a little bit easier to deal with one wholesaler for the distribution of the products you need and the inventory you need to maintain than it is to deal with 24 or maybe even more drug companies all selling individual products, mm-hmm. right? So there is a market niche that these wholesalers have filled, which is convenience for the pharmacies in terms of maintaining their inventories.
But somebody might ask what they add in terms of cost to the entire process.
Probably a little bit. I'm not sure I could quantify it. You know, one would think in a competitive market that that wouldn't be very much. But you're right. Lots of questions can be raised about their effectiveness and their role. The same is true of the pharmaceutical benefit management.
Yeah. Now, that's a group that a lot of us have to interact with, whether it's in our companies or whatever it may be. And we get to know them because they're the people who say yes or no as to whether something is part of a formulary. Explain what that process does, why it's necessary, and perhaps what it adds in terms of cost, but also benefit.
So PBMs really have come about because employers in particular, beginning, you know, 25 years ago or so, started to say, we need someone to help maximize our leverage with the manufacturers of these drugs to get the prices down. So particularly if there are two competing branded products that basically are the same, provide a therapy, you know, are therapies for the same condition, a PBM can come and say, hey, we're going to give preferential treatment to you, manufacturer A. If you give me a good low price for your product and also give us a big rebate based on volume, in other words, the more that's being sold to our patients, the bigger the discount you're going to give us. If you cut a deal with me like that, I will give you a preferred position on my formulary. That is, that means the patient, when they go to the pharmacy, will pay very little for your drug as opposed to your competitor who I will make them pay a lot for. And if they have a preferred position on the formulary, a lower tier, tier two or tier three, their product's going to be consumed a lot more than one on a higher tier.
But Jim, so, why did I also read in your report that a lot of the benefit of these rebates goes directly to the companies and not to the individuals who are sharing that copay?
Well, that's the point. The rebates are generally paid after the fact. So a patient comes in and gets a product. The discounting should be some discount from being on a preferred tier in a formulary. So
yes,
if there's a company that's negotiated a price with a PBM, the price at the point of sale should be somewhat lower as a result of that negotiation. However, the big benefit, the discount that comes through a rebate, that really is paid by the manufacturer to the PBM at the end of the year when they count up how many prescriptions were filled. So it's a volume-based payment that not as individual, you know, it's not targeted to individual patients, and it's sort of an after-the-fact payment from the company manufacturer to the PBM. The PBM anticipates these rebates and uses that to help the employer lower the premium for their insurance.
Okay, so people would see a benefit because they're sharing that premium with their employer.
Absolutely.
I mean, this whole system is almost like a Rube Goldberg contraption. It just seemed a little bit complicated to those of us saying, isn't there a simpler way? I mean, did you look at any other countries? I know they're not necessarily in this report, where things are just a little bit more streamlined than this.
Yeah, I think there are many, many other countries have much more streamlined processes that are, from the patient's perspective, less complicated, less administrative hassle, and they pay much lower prices. So what's not to like,
yeah,
right? So well, how do they do it? Basically, the government sort of take over the pricing of these products. So they just say, we are going to establish a fixed price for these products. and our nationalized system of health will buy them at this rate and dispense them to the patients, you know, very often without any copay whatsoever. If they are prescribed the drug, they just go to the pharmacy and they get it filled, and the nationalized system then pays the manufacturer the price that was pre-negotiated for it.
But when we look at it, our government, as much as price controls may not be the best way to go about this, the government is spending so much money already on health care. And of course, even looking at Medicare, it was only just about a decade ago that we decided prescription drugs should be part of the Medicare benefit. And it's done a little bit differently using, you know, these private providers. But having said that, America is still spending an awful lot of money. Is it spending it effectively in terms of the way our medical dollars that the government is expending really are having an impact that is driving down costs overall?
Those are good questions. First of all, it's a much bigger question beyond prescription drugs.
Of course.
So if you want to look at why our health costs are so high and growing too fast and wasteful, the primary reason would be a dysfunctional way of providing patient care through our hospital systems and our physician networks and clinics and so on. That whole system of providing care wastes a lot of money. It's an overbuilt system. There's too much capital involved. Much routine things are over-medicalized. There's, you know, a host of reasons why that system is way too expensive, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Prescription drugs fit into that. And there's too many prescriptions filled, there's some waste there as well, and the prices can be high for some products. But I'd say that kind of attributing all of our problems with healthcare costs generally to the high prices of prescription drugs is really missing the boat. That's really not what's going on.
What about advertising? I know a lot of people think that that's driving up the cost because it's encouraging us to go to our doctor and say, hey, I saw this on television, and this should solve all my problems. Give me a prescription.
Best way to look at that is to try to get to the evidence of whether a therapy is helping people or not. And the more we can get objective data on, is consumption of these products helping people live healthier lives, or isn't it? Or is it having the opposite effect, perhaps harming them or being unnecessary and not providing any value? And there, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, the idea of direct advertising, there's no question that that is driving some level of consumption and utilization. How would you know, though, for sure if some of that utilization wasn't beneficial? It's a little bit hard to know. You know, someone sees an ad, they say, you know what, I really do have this problem. I wonder if I should talk to my doctor about it, which is what the ads often say. And they talk to their doctor about it, and, you know, some number or percentage of those patients who talk to them, the doctor about it, him or her, you know, it might actually be a beneficial therapy. And for some, it may not be. And so I'm a little bit reluctant to say all of this is bad. Some of it might
No, I understand. It's like advertising. You know, 50% of it is very effective. You just can't figure out what 50%. Let me ask you, there are federal programs and pricing policies in your report. So you talk about the Medicaid drug rebate program. You talk about something called the 340B. Then you talk about the Medicare Part D. Has any of this really given us a new path toward a different approach to prescription drugs and the pricing and the government's role?
Well, I think the introduction of Medicare Part D really was a big step for senior citizens in the sense that they now are getting their drugs in a more organized and pre-negotiated way than many of them were getting them before. Previously, many seniors did not have any insurance coverage for their drugs because Medicare didn't provide it. Some got it through their former employers and so on, but a lot of them paid just out of pocket for it. And that meant that they were paying sort of the maximum price possible and maybe not getting the best deal. And so the introduction of Part B brought more organization and negotiation and somewhat lower prices for seniors for the drugs that they are consuming. So I think that did have a fairly significant effect. One thing that our report emphasizes is that because we don't have a comprehensive system here in the United States, these discounts that are being conferred for slices of the market probably are coming to some degree at the expense of other consumers. In other words, if you're in an employer-based insurance plan, you know, Medicaid is getting these pre-negotiated required discounts, and those who have the 340B discounts and those who are in the VA system have price ceilings on the drugs that they get. All of those are conferred by federal law, but some people have to negotiate just the best deal they can through their PBMs, and they have to pay whatever it is that they can get. That means that the drug companies tend to force higher prices on the people that they don't have required discounts for, because they've had to give discounts to everybody else. So it's not necessarily that every consumer is seeing high prices. It's really probably mostly the people that are less protected by federal law.
You say that one study found that the VA paid an average of 38% of the average price paid for branded products. That sounds pretty generous.
Yeah. Well, the VA smartly did one thing, which was that they, and this is something we recommend really for some, for everybody else, is that they did go ahead and consolidate all of their purchasing power through one formulary. So the VA runs their own, in a sense, PBM, and negotiates directly with the manufacturers for the lowest price they can get for all of their patients. And because they're a pretty big, you know, pretty big health system, they have the nation's largest number of physicians and hospitals and so on under one roof. And they use that leverage to extract the biggest discounts they can from the drug companies. And I think there's a lesson to be learned there, which is that if you have only, you know, one supplier, you know, the more that we can consolidate purchasing power on the demand side to counter the supply, the power that's on the supply side, the better off you are getting discounts.
Now, in your report, you remind us that President Trump has stated on a number of occasions that he intends to pursue policies that would lower the price of prescription drugs. And I saw him in the Rose Garden, I think, announcing something, and I heard a lot of commentary that it didn't do a whole lot.
Yeah, well, they announced the release of a plan through the Department of Health and Human Services. Oh, that must have been 2 months ago in May or so. And late May, I think it was. And it outlined some things they're going to pursue immediately and some things they're thinking about doing and sort of a long-term vision of what they want to do. The bottom line here is that they're still grappling with this problem. I wouldn't say they have a clear idea of exactly how they're going to get a handle on this. The president certainly has committed to it. I think it's fair to say the president committed to this without knowing for sure how he would accomplish it. He just wants it done, and he's putting a lot of pressure on his secretary of HHS to get it done. I think, you know, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt and a little time to try to come forward with more concrete plans, but I would tend to agree with those who say, so far, I wouldn't expect a revolution to occur.
Well, very briefly, what do you think might work broad reforms that we could be making that might help us with this issue of the pricing of prescription drugs?
Well, the first thing that really needs to be looked at and aggressively addressed is that, you know, when you have supply competition, you have, that is, multiple sources for therapies instead of one, then the prices demonstrably come down. So, you know, really the worst situation is when you have a therapy that's really needed by a lot of people and it's effective, and you got one patented product made by one supplier, then they got you. They're going to charge you a lot because everybody wants the drug. They hold the property rights to it.
But, Jim, isn't that the hardest thing? Because they're not really cooperating with each other, I would imagine, a lot of these major drug manufacturers. And it is so costly, and you have different scientists who do look at different compounds and different products to alleviate perhaps the same condition.
Exactly. My point is there are things that can be done through the regulatory process to try to ensure as many products are available as possible from different suppliers. Mm-hmm. So there used to be a notion of, well, we don't want Me Too drugs. Actually, you know, we do want Me Too drugs, because if the drugs are just as effective and they got a different supplier or maybe four or five different suppliers, each one of them, their power goes down quite a bit to charge whatever they
want. By the way, what about the litigation in that? I mean, would we tie ourselves up in court for years if they came out with nearly the same products and yet they had all spent so much money and then they just sue each other and don't allow these things to get to market until they can wrangle this out?
Yeah, I mean, there obviously are patent fights. There are fights that go over the intellectual property a lot. But they get settled eventually, and the courts do come to resolution. And there are many examples of therapies which compete with other therapies to try to treat the same conditions. And different patients react better on different therapies. And so the more therapies that we have, the more supply competition we have, the less you end up in a monopolistic situation where one company is doing something and able to charge a lot for what they're doing.
And beyond that, beyond trying to get some of these products to market from different sources, what else can we do?
Well, the other big thing to do, I think, is to try to get more consolidated power on the purchasing side, and not necessarily through the government. There's going to be great suspicion in this country from some quarters, a lot of quarters, not everybody. A lot of people would support it. But having the government set the price probably would have a major effect on the vibrancy of the industry over time. And so what can we do to consolidate purchasing power short of just handing this over to the federal government? And I think the way to do that is really to, when there is very limited competition, when there maybe is one source for a very important therapy, allow people to designate one, allow the federal government to designate one, two, or three wholesalers or other intermediaries that would negotiate the price on behalf of multiple payers, perhaps maybe even everybody who wanted to buy it at that negotiated price, something like what the VA does for its system.
Mm.
At that point, I think you might get more consolidated purchasing power to say, you know, hey, we're going to all buy through this one formulary. You got to give us the best price. It wouldn't be a panacea, but it might help.
Jim Capretta, I can't thank you enough. This is a great report. No, it really is. And I don't recommend that people read all the reports that we analyze here on America Trends, but this one, I really think people would benefit from understanding the complexities of this. Prescription drug pricing, an overview of the legal, regulatory, and market environment from the American Enterprise Institute. Jim, how can they get their hands on this report?
Please go to aei.org, and you will find at that website a tab for all the scholars there, myself included, as well as Joe Antos, my co-author on this study. If you go to either one of our web pages through that initial web page, you will find the report there and easily can download it and read it yourself.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.